Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Welcome to this Fireside Chat. I am delighted to moderate a session this evening with two leaders of the health partners system here in the Twin Cities in the state of Minnesota. I'm Carolyn Porta. I'm an associate vice president here in the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs at the university. I'm a professor of nursing and I practice clinically as a sexual assault nurse examiner for the Regents Hospital program here in St. Paul. I'm delighted to introduce our two guests this evening and to certainly welcome the interns and colleagues on this fireside chat to raise questions, to engage in conversation, to learn from two wonderful colleagues. If you would introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to be where you are. Tonight I have Ms. Andrea Walsh, President and Chief Executive Officer with Health Partners, and I have Dr. Patrick Cornea, who's the Chief Health Plan Medical Officer, also with Health Partners. Andrea, would you like to kick us off?
Sure. Thanks, Carolyn. And it's great to be with all of you this evening. I'm happy Pat and I were talking earlier today. We're excited to have the opportunity to have a dialogue really with you this evening. I've been with Health Partners now for quite a long time. I joined the organization in 1994 and have spent the greater part of my career at Health Partners. And part of what has kept me at the organization is just the multidisciplinary nature of the work that we do as an organization. Our mission is health and well-being. It's why we exist. It's our purpose, if you will. And we carry that mission out through a combination, through bringing together the capabilities we have as a care delivery system, both medical and dental and pharmacy services, so the full continuum of care, a robust health plan capability that includes health and well-being capabilities, and a research and education institute. And it's kind of the combination of these three different areas of expertise we bring together. And I think for me, it has led to a fascinating career and the opportunity to work in health and well-being, in healthcare administration, and in health plan administration, as well as research. I started my career actually not in healthcare. I went to the University of Kansas and was a business and English major. Business because I thought that's what would help me get a job. I had no idea what I wanted to do. It seemed at the time that a business degree would be a good practical thing to have. And English, because I've long had a love of language, of reading, of writing. And so the combination, the dual major for me, appealed to both kind of head and heart together. I then went on to law school at the University of Minnesota in the mid 80s. And on graduating from law school, began my career actually as a lawyer and practiced law for several years, and then had the opportunity actually for some public service. I went to the Minnesota Health Department as an assistant commissioner of health. And I think there for me, it really awakened the passion I have around public policy and really the heart I have for healthcare. I grew up in a healthcare family, and I can share later a little bit about how that influenced my career path. But that's just in brief sort of who I am and a snippet of my career trajectory.
Thank you for that introduction. There's a lot to follow up on there, including the fact that President Gabel, our current president, who is the first female president here at the university, also comes from that business law background. Patrick.
Sure. My name is Patrick Cornier. I'm a family doc and practiced for 23 years in Roseville here in the Twin Cities area. And had kind of a wandering path, I suppose, to becoming a chief medical officer. Started out with just some leadership positions within our own medical group. I actually served on the board of directors for Health Partners during the 90s as a physician member of their network. And that got me exposed to Health Partners as an organization and gave me a chance to see from the very leadership level, top leadership level, how they led that organization in a way that was thoroughly consistent with the values that Andrea just spoke to. And that was really intriguing to me. The idea of leadership and having an impact on how an organization like that with a mission like that can have a really positive impact on communities and individuals is a pretty nice thing to be able to participate in. I practiced full spectrum family medicine, which is delivering babies, taking care of patients in hospitals, running to the emergency room. If a patient went in and they could wait for me to come and stitch up a wound or something. And then of course, primary care from birth to end of life in a way that I think is unusual now, but gave me a breadth of experience and contact across the entire healthcare system that's served me really well. I grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota. So I moved to the Twin Cities and went to St. Thomas to come into a more temperate climate and spent the vast majority of my career here. I did spend 6 years in California working in a similar role with Kaiser Permanente, a group out there and across the country, but came back to Minnesota attracted by this position here at Health Partners, attracted to Minnesota as a place where all of our children and grandchildren are, and you know, being able to reconnect there has been a lot of fun and a really good decision for us. Just with regards to the kinds of things that I guess excite me about work in healthcare and work in promoting health. It's one of the few ways that you can connect to something that is central to individuals' lives across the community. And especially when you're working in a profession or in an area where individuals and families give you a great deal of trust. They express that trust by sharing their most intimate realities. And if you can treat that trust with respect and develop longstanding relationships, you can be there for them when they most need you and have a chance to make an impact. So it's been great to be able to do that. It's been great to be able to assume roles in a leadership position. And it's also great to be able to be back here in Minnesota.
How long have you been back?
It was 2 years ago right now that I drove from California to Minnesota from one lockdown to another lockdown due to the pandemic.
Wow. Thanks for sharing those introductions and a bit of your backgrounds. Interns that are on the call, certainly use the chat box if you come up with any questions as our guests are sharing. I'm curious, you both started out obviously as professionals in your careers. You didn't have to choose a leadership pathway. What was it about you that you knew that was the right path for you? You knew you had the skills or could develop the skills to be successful. I would love for you to share a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I think careers, oftentimes people think careers are A to B to C points, like a straight line, and you know when you start where you're going and what you ultimately want to do. And I think for me, my own leadership path really was a result of doing well in the role, whatever role you're in, and constantly looking for opportunities to grow and to learn and to be exposed to new and different things. So I think about, you know, practicing in a law firm, and one of the partners in the law firm saw in me something I wouldn't have seen necessarily in myself, which is, gosh, you would be a really good lawyer at the for the health department as they're looking at regulations. And you know, you should explore that opportunity. And I think, you know, part of a leadership trajectory is being willing to take risks and being willing to discover what is it that you like about a role, what is it that you don't like about a role. And I think for me, going to the health department gave me really my first leadership opportunity. And it was, you know, really being put into the deep end of the pool, so to speak, in terms of leadership lessons, because I had really, up to that point in my career, I had been an individual contributor. I had played on a team. The team was a team of lawyers in big litigation cases, but really supervising and leading a team. I was blessed to have some really strong leaders that were part of my team and really helped me learn and grow as a leader. And you know, I think that that's something you take with you in each phase of your leadership. You learn something, and as you move on. And I found that I loved working with people. I loved leading people, developing people, and the work that comes from really being a coach, figuring out how do you draw out the best in others, and bring barriers down to help support others in the work that needs to be done in partnership.
Yeah, the fact that you raised both that curiosity and willingness to take risks is, I think, really important. You know, there are probably multiple turning points, but the one that comes to mind for me was fairly early in my practice during a quarterly medical staff meeting at St. John's Hospital out here in Maplewood. All of us doctors were down in the basement conference room of the hospital, and everybody was grumbling about the latest thing that had upset us about what was happening in healthcare finance and public policy and federal policy and all of that stuff. And I was participating in the grumbling until I realized, you know, it doesn't do a lot of good for us to be here in the basement of this community hospital grumbling about what's being done to us. And so really at that point, just decided I'm going to start exploring a little bit. And I threw my hat in the ring to become chief of family medicine, ultimately became chief of staff. And at St. John's, as chief of staff, they gave you the chance to participate at the board level. What I loved about that was, you know, as a community physician, we always wondered what was in the heads of hospital administrators when they were making their decisions. And as I got into it, it just really gave me a great deal greater insight into the fact that everybody's really trying hard to do the right thing with the information and perspective that they bring to the table. And if you can tap into that, understand that well enough, you can really make some interesting things happen, even if you're not maybe a part of that professional category. And from there, went into actually the invitation to become a member of the board with Health Partners, which gave me a lot better and broader understanding of healthcare finance, and particularly with Health Partners, because it is an integrated organization. Gave me a chance to see the interaction and interplay between healthcare delivery and healthcare finance and how complicated that can be, and how, really bright, motivated people trying hard to do the right thing in an imperfect world can accomplish some pretty cool stuff. And so that kind of curiosity just propelled me forward. And every time somebody asked me to do something, I was inclined to say yes and see how it went. So, it was really just pursuing that curiosity and an interest in learning what's going on across the system.
Thanks for those reflections. I appreciate what I'm hearing, not only about opportunity and open doors, but also being willing to take some risks, certainly saying yes to opportunities and having the creativity, but also seeing a problem and wanting to be a part of solving it. I think those are some of those attributes and characteristics that cause us to say, this isn't okay, I'm going to do something about it. I heard someone somewhere, and I've been saying this a few times ever since I heard it because I love it. The way to solve a bad idea is not to fixate on it, but to come up with a better one. And I think a lot of times we can get stuck in that space of just being frustrated about something that's not working, about a disparity and inequity, a procedure gone wrong, whatever the irritation is, instead of saying, okay, how can we prevent this from happening again? And what can we do better or differently or more effectively, more efficiently? So thank you for those reflections. Is there a skill, one of the questions that interns have asked in the past, is there a skill that you wished you would have focused on developing earlier in your life that you think would have served you had you gotten it a little bit earlier, served you better?
Oh gosh, it's such a long list. I think.
And I was thinking of those lessons that you learn year over year, again and again and again. That's where I'm going to go.
Yeah. Repetition is my best friend, actually. I think a part of what I wish I had learned sooner was a deeper respect for the wisdom of the front line. Mm-hmm. Early in practice, it was just really common. We would come together as the physician leaders of the practice, and we would every 2 weeks go through the business issues, but then also each of us would have a little bit of an irritation from something that happened when a patient was scheduled into the wrong kind of a slot or some other thing didn't go right. And so we, in our wisdom, impressed by our own credentials, would troubleshoot and come up with a great solution and then hand it over to the poor office manager to implement. And before long, of course, you had such a complicated set of rules and expectations that they were unworkable. And the best solution that I found was ultimately going to the front desk and listening in as people answered the phones and listening to exactly what they were dealing with and what positions we kind of put them in to say, we can't solve a problem without the people who are responsible for implementing what it is that we're doing. And I think gaining that insight, even just a few years earlier, would have made my life better, but more importantly, their lives better and our patients' lives better earlier than they did.
So let me jump on that before you also contribute, Andrea. How do you do that today? Patrick, how do you get frontline input as a pretty high leader in your system and patient input?
Well, there's a couple of things I would say. First of all, I keep three words in mind all the time. The first is humility, having a deep sense of personal humility and recognizing that you can't, in fact, you don't know everything. The second is respect. It's respect for what everybody brings to the table, everybody brings into the room, everybody brings to the conversation. And then the third is curiosity. When you bring that personal humility, the willingness to learn new things, and you communicate to others that you respect what they have to bring to the table, combine that with curiosity and you've really got a great mix. I think probably some of the most important things that we do at the more senior leadership level is ask questions about that input. Where did we gather the input we need to know that the decisions that we're moving towards are well informed by the people affected by those decisions? How did you, as a leader of your team, gather the necessary information to know that whatever you're going to be doing will be a positive thing for the people doing the work, that it will be patient-centered, family-centered. And by doing that, and then setting up forums to do that somewhat formally, but then also expecting informal, constant curiosity about that, asking questions, being present on the unit in the hospital, being present at the front desk, like I described, listening to those phone calls and seeing what people were going through. I think those are the sort of processes and signals that are most important.
Those are great. Thank you.
Yeah, just to build on that, I'm thinking within Health Partners, rounding is a big part of leadership and taking the time intentionally to be present in different locations with different teams and to inquire, as Pat said, how are things going, and not take the first answer, because rarely Do you get the answer on the first ask, but really asking repeatedly and in different ways how things are going? Where are we doing well? Where do we need to do better? What opportunities do you see for us to do better? And just genuinely seeking that feedback. The other thing we've instituted since the pandemic are what we call all colleague connects, which are just virtual meetings for 45 minutes to an hour that are open mic time for dialogue and discussions with leaders, but the opportunity for colleagues to ask anything and everything on their mind. And we do our best to answer the questions real time, but then also take in questions and publish them on My Partner, which is our internal intranet. I wanted in terms of leadership lessons learned, I also wanted to build on Pat's comments about one of the things that I wish I had learned earlier and constantly still learn, and that is the reminder that a leader's job is not to fix problems. A leader's job is to slow down and make sure that we capably define the problems that need to be solved, because I think many of us as leaders and human beings, and especially in healthcare, we're fixers, right? See something, fix it. And sometimes you fix something that is only a symptom of the underlying problem. And so really, you know, developing the discipline as a leader to define the problem, and then the art of delegation, knowing when do you roll up your sleeves and engage side by side with your team in getting the work done, and when do you empower the team to get the work done and engage with you in other ways. And, you know, how is it that you optimize the resource you have amongst your people most effectively? And that I really feel like is the constant leadership lesson, is to resist the urge to solve and instead to explore how you define.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. That's something we could reflect on for a while. I love being a leader in the room listening, and really taking the time to listen and hear what people have to say. I think as you lead more, you talk less over time in a lot of these spaces, and it tends to serve you well. Taylor, you asked a question about burnout, and I want to preface this by making a link slightly to the frontline worker comments that were made earlier, and mention an article I was reading from the early 1990s, maybe 93. There was an article summarizing a study addressing burnout in healthcare workers. And I share that to say that this isn't a new problem, but certainly the pandemic has exaggerated for us in our generation burnout to an extent that it really hadn't been perhaps before. Taylor, do you want to pose your question? Or I certainly will.
Sure. I guess my main question, and I sort of asked this because I actually work at Regions as a health unit coordinator. So it's kind of interesting to be able to talk to leaders on that side and sort of see like what you guys have sort of done for employees during the pandemic, you know, if you're sort of willing to share that. I'm only working in a part-time role, but yeah.
What are you pursuing as a degree? Go ahead and share a little bit of your pursuit.
Oh, sure. So I'm actually in the MHA program, and I'm in my second year, so I'll be graduating in May.
Wonderful.
Cool.
And I would love to hear from your perspective, what do you see within the organization that's been done? Because I think, you know, there's no question, it has been an incredibly hard time the last couple of years. And I think, you know, at Health Partners, we've thought about it as really it's the dual pandemic. It's the COVID-19 pandemic. And then on top of it, it's the murder of George Floyd and the social and racial injustice in the community and the feeling of frustration, of fear and anger that surrounds that. And I think that the combination has been particularly challenging within organizations is, you know, at Health Partners, we talk about aspiring to be a place where everyone is welcomed, included, and valued. And so I would say one of, you know, there are a couple of things lately that we've been talking about as examples of what we need to do to support colleagues' health and well-being. And one of them is we need to make sure that we're staffed up and that we're taking care of the staff that we have, that we retain the people that we have. That's job number one. We're a people business and a people industry. We need to have strong and healthy people. The second is belonging. It's really important that people sense that sense of belonging when you're in it together as part of a team. It's a lot easier to weather things than when you feel like you're alone. And a lot of times in practice in clinics and sometimes within hospitals as well, it can be an isolating practice. And that exam room door closes and you are practicing with colleagues, but you're isolated. And so we've really been looking at how do we break down some of the barriers and create more of a sense of belonging. The other thing we've done is taken a look at how do we help colleagues that need help with, you know, some need well-being resources, and we've got a lot of well-being resources, but many need mental health support and resources, employee assistance program resources, and how do we make sure we make it okay to talk about mental illness, to talk about anxiety, to talk about depression, to talk about how you feel, and to encourage colleagues to talk to each other, to encourage leaders to reach out and check in with staff. And there, you know, sadly, there's not any one thing. It needs to be, you know, sort of eight times eight ways. And depending on the person, what support feels like looks different. So we're an organization, as Taylor knows, of 26,000 people. And so finding the right resource and matching the resource with the person and with the team, I think is one of our greatest challenges. I'd also say the needs in our hospital and the needs in our clinic and the needs in our administrative area look quite different. So burnout in a hospital can show up in a way that's quite different than burnout for an administrative team member who's been working remote for the last 2 years and has been isolated, you know, with everything at home and at work changing. And so we've tried to figure out there, you know, what a solution is that isn't a one size fits all, but allows us and enables us to reach people with the resources that make sense.
Yeah, I only have one thing to add. Early in the pandemic, you know, there was all of the coverage of the communities talking about the heroism of the care systems and the care providers, the nurses, the physicians, and everybody who supported them. And that on the one hand feels really good, but there's a lot of pressure and a lot of loneliness that's wrapped up in being a hero. And the healthcare industry tends to train and promote the idea of individual heroism. And what I think Andrea just described is creating cultural space to not feel that burden, to share that amongst your colleagues as a member of a team, being able to share your frustrations and share the things that are troubling you the most, to give a space off of the main line to just take a brief break when you need to. All of those different things that help to let people know that you're not an individual hero, you're a member of a team, and the team is there to help you, and the organization is there to help you.
You know, as you're saying that, it's also reminding me of one other thing that I think has really challenged healthcare teams across the industry, and that is the movement from being a hero in the early phase of the pandemic to being not trusted in the latter part. And I think that maybe more than anything is the thing that just cuts to the quick and you know, wounds and is the trauma that so many of our healthcare team members feel. And that is the trust divide, going from a trusted member of the community to someone where we've got patients and family members, you know, not only not trusting you, but not really being respectful about it either. And there's been just sort of a break in respect in the workplace that I think has really been a pylon and is something that's being talked about not only within our organization, but within the industry at both a local and a national level. And I think that the trust rebuild is going to be a long path, but is vital to the well-being of the healthcare field for the long haul.
Definitely. Taylor, do you want to follow up or offer your observations being in the workplace?
Yeah, I was going to say the employee assistance program and things that those sorts of things that I've seen have been super helpful. But I think you also talking about the culture, I see that in the teams, right? Like people stay and people pick up shifts when there aren't people because they love their coworkers and really, you know, want to help each other out. So it was nice to just kind of see it from that leadership side, because when you experience it sort of on the front lines, you wonder what were those conversations on the other end. So I appreciate both of your input on that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'll add also, having been an employee with Health Partners for quite some time clinically, I recall an exercise many years ago, the DOT initiative. I don't know if you remember it, but each employee was given a certain number of dots that they had their badge. And when you greeted somebody or helped somebody out, a coworker, and they felt valued, they felt helped or supported, they might give you one of their dots. And it was a very little sort of cheesy thing, frankly, but it really exemplified for me the spirit of what was being infused from the leaders to every part of the organization. And I can tell you that there isn't a day that I'm not in one of the five hospitals where I pass somebody and they're saying hello, they're looking me in the eye, and I'm doing the same. And it doesn't matter what our badge title says, we're there to be a part of the team and to help each other out. And I know not every organization experiences that at all. So I think that's a positive for sure.
I think one of the things we've tried to focus on, and it's something that means a lot to me, is just gratitude and taking the time personally to reflect on what are you grateful for each day. And some days it's big things and some days it's little things, but I think staying centered in gratitude helps as a leader and helps just as a human being. Keep things in perspective. And I think that's been important as we look back and as important as we move forward, I mean, you know, just given what is going on in the world today.
Yeah, one of the practices that I did to apply that gratitude I can share with this group when I came into the role of associate vice president is that I made it a practice to ask those who are directly reporting to me to acknowledge or recognize in their written weekly updates or biweekly updates, someone on their team that stood out for some reason. And then I would issue that just an email or a call or offer to have coffee, just an expression of gratitude a few steps away from that person. And the feedback I got was that was very meaningful to those individuals. And sometimes it was a team of people. So as you think about the way you express gratitude to those in your close circles, and I'm looking at the interns now, and future as leader, how would you put that gratitude into practice? It's one thing to say that you want to live that, and then it's another thing to actually live it, you know, practically. So I have a question for the system. There are some job postings these days around the country where, as part of the benefit package, you will read that a benefit is unlimited PTO. And I believe that those organizations believe that people will be so enthusiastic about working with them and joining their team that they will take vacation when they want to. It will actually be more of a struggle to find time to take vacation. Hypothetically, if you were to offer unlimited PTO to every single person in your organization, do you think that they're so happy to come to work they'd really continue doing that, or would there be certain sectors that would take a lot of vacation?
I think that's a great question. I don't know. What I know for sure is we need people to take their PTO. If you don't recharge, you have to take a break. I do think, though, your question leads into another question, which is, what do benefits look like in the future, and how do health systems like ours evaluate the benefits we offer, whether it's medical, dental, maternity, paternity care, PTO hours, disability, 401k, retirement, and we need to figure out to be an attractive place to spend your career. What do benefits look like? And with 26,000 colleagues across a spread of ages, across a spread of communities, it might not look the same everywhere. So we're just embarking from a leadership standpoint on exploring those questions and trying to make sure that our benefits keep pace with not only community expectations, but for who we want to be as an employer.
And while I was in California, that was my benefit. That I didn't get PTO. I could be as gone as much as I wanted to, as long as I got my goals taken care of and got the job done. Now, of course, that means you don't take very much PTO, partly because the job is so demanding. The other thing that I think is important to pull through in all of this is remember the job as a source of meaning for individuals. Being able to create an environment where personal mission and organizational mission are well aligned, and you feel that connection when you come to work, is a really important dynamic. And, Andrea and I were both talking about some of the things that we do at Health Partners to help with the issue of burnout and well-being. And you, as you are entering and moving along your career paths, you're going to be in all kinds of different situations where leaders or organizations make similar promises, but the behavior day to day is different, and in the behavior of individuals will be different. And making those observations and learning lessons from those, I think, are going to be really helpful as you move through your career.
So let's follow up on that really briefly, and I know we're coming toward the end, almost, not quite. If these interns are applying for their first job or their first leadership gig, what can they look for? What should they look for? What should they ask if they have that one interview to get to know the flavor and spirit of the team they might be joining? What might help tease out some red flags?
I think questions that explore culture, to Pat's point, what's it like to work here? Day in, day out, because no amount of money and benefits can take care of a bad culture, a bad work environment. You spend so much time at work. Take a look around and make sure that the work environment, the people, the team are functioning as such. I mean, I think, we're often asked, like, what are the attributes of a leader? At Health Partners, what makes for a successful leader, and what kind of skills do you need to have? And boy, teamwork is job number one. Hiring people who aren't willing to play on a team and play well together, it destroys culture if you don't have the ability to play well together. And that doesn't mean that you have to always agree with each other, but it means that you need to have constructive ways to facilitate dialogue around areas of disagreement. So conflict resolution, how conflicts get resolved or not, is a good question. How people relate to each other, whether people take time off or not. I mean, some work environments are no time for time off. I think, you know, to Taylor's point earlier about people's willingness to take an extra shift, we literally as leaders had to also try to simultaneously communicate, hey, if we paid you and ask you to take another shift and you need the time, please know it's okay. We don't have a neat and tidy way to know if we can ask you one more time, but please feel okay in saying, I can't work another shift or I can't do that next week. So trying to discern a culture that really respects a work-life balance, I think in the industry is really, really important.
And I don't know that it's a common question asked, but one of the things that I always ask when I'm interviewing folks for my team is not what position do you aspire to, but what difference would you like to make? Connecting more with that personal mission and in so doing kind of helping to connect with what the organization wants to do. And I think being able to ask of someone who's interviewing you questions like, you know, what do you think are the most important leadership attributes that you bring to the table or something along those lines where you're, because it's a common expression that people don't leave organizations, they leave their managers. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're interviewing with someone, recognizing that that's going to be what your world is, regardless of what the organization promises, and getting a sense of that is going to be important for you.
Definitely. Let me follow up on taking time for yourself and balance. How do the two of you rejuvenate and take care of yourselves?
Well, 11 grandkids helps. like I said, we came back here to be able to spend more time with them. Lots of outdoor activities, snowshoeing and those kinds of things. We have a little forest property up near the Lake Superior that we love to spend time in. Love to read. Lately, I've been just exploring world history as written from the voice of, minority communities, getting their perspective on history of the United States and other things like that. So exploring those kinds of things with curiosity. And then just spending time with friends, especially now that we can see them face to face, is a real way to recharge.
Thanks.
Yeah, I just recently shared in our All Colleague Connects, you know, as I look back on the last 2 years, I lost a little bit of work-life balance, honestly, and found that COVID turned into sort of a 24/7 proposition. And you can have phases where mm-hmm. things are a little bit out of balance, but 2 years is too long a phase. And so one of the things in this new year that I've been doing a better job of is reestablishing that boundary, really protecting evenings and weekends, just doing that, because if you don't do it, nobody will do it for you. I also find, like Pat, that exercise, a good night's sleep and diet for me all go hand in hand. And if I am in the pattern of exercising first thing in the morning, my day always goes better. I tend to then make better food choices and I always sleep better at night. And if any one of those legs of the stool falls apart, the other two kind of travel right with them. So I really try to get exercise first thing in the morning as a way to start my day. It helps me keep perspective, actually.
Yeah, for sure. I agree 100% with that. Sherry has a question related to some interprofessionality.
I do. I had the pleasure yesterday having a long meeting in the afternoon with Michelle Noltemeyer. And so for the interns who don't know, Michelle is the director for program development at Health Partners and in charge of their student clinical education. And it's clear in talking to Michelle that there's a real value on interprofessional care. And I've heard it here tonight, right? When you talk about teamwork is number one and Taylor recognizing the team picking that up. And if you could speak a little bit to where does that value come from? You know, I've been talking to a lot of systems in my co-director hat, and I don't see that everywhere. And so where does that value for interprofessional practice and interprofessional education that seems so true, where does that come from? And then how do you spread this throughout your organization of 26,000 people? I would just love to hear you comment on that and recognizing you for the work you're doing on interprofessional care.
Thank you. I appreciate that call out. Maybe Pat and I can tag team this. You know, we have four values at Health Partners, and I think that is at the core what leads to that collegiality and interprofessional development out of necessity to get the work done. So our values are partnership, compassion, integrity, partnership, and excellence. And, you know, frankly, I bookend partnership and excellence in my book. You can't have partnership. You can't have excellence without interdisciplinary teams, right? I mean, healthcare is a team sport. And so I think our values articulate that the value we place on interdisciplinary work. The other thing I would say is having a consumer board, being an organization with a board of directors that's focused on how do we make sure people get the care they need and are able to pay for it, that integration at our core makes us think differently. I mean, we're neither a delivery system that owns a health plan or a health plan that owns a delivery system. We are, by the very nature of who we are, both. And so I think, you know, we tend to manage the polarity differently than other organizations who can, you know, point a finger at another part of the organization. And for us, it's like, well, that does no good. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help us solve the problems our patients and members need us to solve or help us achieve health and well-being.
And the only thing I would add to that is I mentioned three words early on in my comments. The first two, humility, recognizing that everybody, you don't know everything, and then respect, recognizing that others have a lot to offer, are critically important. That really opens the door to welcoming anybody to your team who can make a positive difference for the patients, the communities that we're trying to serve. I think there's another thing that we have focused on for a long, long time, and that is quality and the ability to understand what it takes to drive quality and having the courage to face the numbers when the numbers tell you you're not delivering. All of those things have gotten us really comfortable with asking each other, so you think you're so good, you better prove it. So whenever somebody who's very impressed by their own credentials maybe does something that is less than respectful to a team member, you know, we're willing to call that out and say, you know, you're not all that. These are important members of the team. And if you can't respect that, that's not going to make it here. So I think all of those things weave together to create an environment where you see, I'm grateful, but not surprised that sort of interdisciplinary camaraderie, collegiality, and commitment to the patient and their family's well-being comes through. One of the things that, you know, we've got healthcare delivery, we've got healthcare finance, we've got research, and we've got education, which means that we've got all of the tools. It also means we've got no excuses. If we've got all that, we should be able to put those together in ways that that really make a difference.
Thanks for sharing.
So there's a wrap-up question we like to do, reflecting on books, music, media, podcasts that you enjoy or might recommend. So I'll give you a minute to think about that, and I'll throw one more question in here. How do you maneuver through the relationships with friendly competitors in the state and the region? I know during the pandemic, we heard the commissioner talk about the health systems coming together. We know you are certainly sharing data with each other, perhaps more than you might have pre-pandemic. How's that frenemy relationship?
I think Pat and I both are firm believers that you wanna compete on what matters, but you gotta collaborate to get there. And I think of quality as being the best example of that. And I think it positioned us well during the pandemic to be able to collaborate with competing care systems and competing health plans. And the quality references in Minnesota, we have long agreed that we should compete on quality outcomes, but not on the yardstick you measure quality. So let's agree how we measure clinical quality, and then let's get after improving quality. As we improve it, let's share it with each other in the quest to be better and in what we owe the community. And I think, in the pandemic, frankly, collaboration was mission critical, whether it was around testing or vaccination, or frankly, hospital beds and making sure that we were able to provide as much care as the community needed using all of our resources together. So, it's one of the things I will feel most proud about in looking back on the pandemic is the incredible partnership across the community. Our health plans in Minnesota, unlike many other states, came together early on and decided that we would all cover testing and COVID-related care. And I think that was really important in paving the way for making sure that people were able to access the care they needed timely. Pat was a big part of that.
It was, I used to, like many others from our community, go around the country and talk about some of the things that we were accomplishing in the Minnesota marketplace with regards to progress on quality and collaboration. And a common response was, well, Minnesota is just a weird place and, your lessons don't apply here. And so I got to where I had a couple of slides in my presentation deck. One was a slide that just listed, these are the great things in Minnesota that we take advantage of. And they may even be unique to Minnesota. And my next slide was, now get over it. And my point was, we had those tools, you've got yours. Once something has been proven possible, then all everybody is doing is making excuses if they're not driving in the same direction. And so there was a foundation, I think, of experience and trust among the systems that made that cooperation during the pandemic possible. And that takes work.
I love that. I saw some smiles there. Those were good words. I love it. All right. Podcasts, movies, things you've been reading, reflecting on that you think the interns might enjoy hearing about. They just had spring break, so now they'll probably have to wait till summer break, but nonetheless, we'll compile the list.
Well, I could throw out actually some podcasts. First of all, movies. Both Michelle and I spent 15 or 20 minutes at the end of Belfast blubbering like babies. Beautiful movie. Anyway, there are some podcasts that I regularly listen to, and there's one new one that I'm just beginning to get into. That one's Revisionist History with Malcolm Gladwell. That's been going on for like 5 or 6 years, and the title is just intriguing to me because, as I've been doing the reading, like I talked about before, hearing the stories of our history from different perspectives has made me very curious about that kind of thing. I also like Sway with Kara Swisher. She is deeply connected to the tech industry and was embedded in the Bay Area and has a healthy skepticism about the tech industry, is not afraid to ask tough questions. And despite that, she gets all the best guests. So really good. There's another one, The Experiment with Julia Longoria. And it's a series of podcasts that explore questions about the experiment, the American experiment, in really intriguing ways. In fact, one of the stories, it was a three-part series, focused on spam, and that's all I'll say about it. It's really fascinating. And then another one that I really like is The Ezra Klein Show. And that's one that is focused just on world issues. He's been bringing in some really amazing guests recently with deep expertise in the history of Eastern Europe and Ukraine and economics. And I find it really stretches my thinking and pushes me into areas where I, you know, just historically have not spent a lot of time. So those are some that I would recommend.
It's a great list. One of yours reminded me of one I enjoy. I had to pull it up to know exactly what it is, but it's called How It Began, A History of the Modern World. That's been a fun one for me. And I like different genres. So depending on my mood when I'm walking or working out or with the dogs or cooking. Yeah. Andrea?
I love to read. So I'll add on to the podcast with a couple of book suggestions. Simon Sinek's The Infinite Game is a book that I would recommend. He is the author of It Starts With Why, which is also a great book. I also love presidential historians. And so pretty much anything that Doris Kearns Goodwin has written, I like. And she writes a weekly article in the Wall Street Journal every Saturday morning that it, from a current event standpoint, is always very interesting. But her Leadership in Turbulent Times is her most recent novel. It's a couple years old now, but it's really a good one. And then I recently reread John Meacham's The Soul of America, Searching for Our Better Angels. It's an excellent book where he explores what are leadership attributes, what made leaders from different eras, strong leaders, effective leaders, and what were flat sides. I just think what's going on across the world right now draws me into some of those presidential historians, if nothing else, just to help you feel better about what can feel like just a real mess that we're in as a society.
Thank you for that. And I'm not sure we want to end with a quote about the mess of society.
True.
Yeah. But that said, why not? Because it is really how we have felt the last few years. And while we're, at least in our part of the country, we're in a little bit of a calm right now. And we don't know what the future will hold. But frankly, I'm very hopeful. So. And I'm hopeful, having heard both of you share some of your experiences, your candor, really grateful for the time tonight. It's been a delight.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.